Welcome to International Dispute Negotiation, your guide to resolving disputes everywhere.
This is Mike McElrath, and this podcast is about different ways of accepting and managing the risks of dispute resolution, presenting them through the eyes of experts from different countries and backgrounds. Speaking today with Wolf von Kumburg, who's the your senior counsel, or actually assistant general counsel, for Northrop Grumman in Europe.
That I am indeed, yes.
You want to tell us a little bit about your position, and since we're here in London, and you're not originally from London, how you got to London?
All right. Well, it's a long story. I guess I started out as a litigator. I worked for a firm in Toronto. I was raised and educated largely in Toronto, although I came to the UK in 1984 to attend Cambridge University, qualified as a solicitor here in England. Went back to Canada and went to work for Litton Industries, who were a defense and commercial electronics company. Litton had an opening in Europe with their law department in 1992, and I then came across to Zurich. In fact, that's where Litton had their European headquarters. We made an acquisition in the UK in 1997, and they asked me to come across here to help integrate that company into Litton. So largely, I've been here in the UK since 1997. Northrop Grumman purchased Litton in 2001, and so I became part of the Northrop Law Department at that time.
So you're a successful integration story.
Absolutely, I'm still here.
Well, it's, and Northrop Grumman, just for those who may not know the business, given that you are a little bit like us in that you provide, we provide infrastructure that people often don't see, that it's important to have. You provide a lot of military systems and equipment.
That's right. I mean, Northrop, in fact, has varied business groups, just as GE does. Although 90% of our business is military, and we build everything from aircraft to aircraft carriers to satellites to electronic systems and subsystems that are used in various military platforms.
So it sounds like you view yourselves the way we would, which is as primarily a technology company. You know.
That's correct. We're really an engineering house.
Engineering company,
and,
yeah.
Basically, we'll design to the requirements that the customer has and then manufacture.
So very similar, but yet very different in many ways. Obviously, different customers, different product lines, but yet we both view ourselves as being big in the technology and engineering.
Right.
And interestingly enough, you and I have something in common, and that is that we both are very active, and as are our companies, in promoting mediation. I know why I like mediation. Why should tell me why you like it?
Well, I must say, I mean, Northrop Grumman themselves are very keen supporters of ADR. They've been members of CPR for many, many years, have also signed the CPR pledge. Have won actually several awards in Los Angeles for their use of mediation, and have promoted mediation very strongly in our particular industry. And I must say, I think our industry as a whole has embraced ADR and mediation in particular, perhaps because it's a very small industry. There aren't that many players.
You're so relationships
dealing with the same people, so relationships are extremely important. I think you'll find there have been very few actual lawsuits between the major aerospace companies in the United States.
By the way, for those who don't know, the CPR pledge is a pledge between among companies to try mediation. If a dispute arises, particularly between them, we would go first to mediation before we would go to a binding litigation.
That's correct, yeah. It's not a binding contractual document, but it is, as it says, a pledge whereby, wherever possible, these companies will first try mediation. I personally have been keen on mediation for some time. When I was still at Litton, I was involved in a major lawsuit between Litton and one of its bitter rivals, Honeywell, with respect to navigation system technology. It was a bitter lawsuit that I saw went on for about 10 years between the two parties and drained an awful lot of money that could have been utilized for research and development out of Litton. And where there were certain opportunities over those years to settle the matter, it in fact didn't, simply because of the emotions, I think,
personalities
that were involved,
incredible.
And the personalities.
You know, people would think that working with engineers, you wouldn't have these problems. You know, but in fact, I find it's probably the opposite. You know.
Oh, absolutely. I think engineers are extremely competitive people, I think,
and they live in a black and white world.
They do, and Litton felt that Honeywell had stolen something from them, and they were simply going to get back at Honeywell no matter what the cost. And
probably people at Honeywell who were feeling very similar.
There definitely were. And so in the end, this lawsuit, as I say, went on for almost 10 years. It was resolved, and this is a good lesson, I think, when Allied Signal bought Honeywell and Northrop bought Litton. So you had now two organizations that had none of the emotional baggage, and the two of them were able to sit down and very quickly hammer out a solution to the issue, and the matter resolved. Basically, I think, on the same premise that it could have resolved, very early on in the litigation.
You know, it's interesting. I think that we have also seen in the business that I'm part of, oil and gas, opportunities to settle cases when we acquire companies. It is, you have a window of opportunity, and it's tough with the size of the business. A big business, maybe you have a year in which you're still not seen to be, in terms of the perception of the other side, as the same person or people who started the dispute, and you haven't yet acquired the acquired company's emotions and emotional investment in the dispute. So it's about a year when you can actually step in and just kind of get rid of the stuff that should be gotten rid of.
Yeah, I think that's a great opportunity to be able to do that when you acquire a new entity. But our own view, I think, is certainly on the legal side. And I think also our top management, they just see litigation as being such a drain on the company, not simply the costs that we pay to our outside lawyers, but it's the internal opportunity costs that are lost, pulling engineers off of current projects to deal with past problems. Just isn't seen as an efficient use of those resources.
I have a problem right now with an engineer who we need to have at a trial next week. And his boss is fighting with us, saying, "I need him to go meet with a customer."
Right.
You got to say, look, we could have avoided the litigation by settling, but instead we're in the litigation.
Yeah, absolutely. So we actually have a process, and you may have something similar at GE, that where all litigation and even potential litigation is reviewed early on to determine whether we can't utilize some form of ADR. Normally, that'll be mediation.
Do you use an early case assessment?
Yeah, so we do, absolutely. Yeah. That is something that we use, and we then review a case that is already in litigation every 6 months, actually, to determine whether it might not be appropriate to utilize some means of ADR.
That's a great process. I mean, the early case assessment is a wonderful way, even if you don't settle, at least you've got a higher level of confidence that you're going down the right process.
Right.
Have you been to mediations then with senior managers in the company?
Yeah. Yes.
It's a whole different experience from an arbitration or a court litigation.
It is, absolutely. Well, I think it's good to focus the minds of senior management on issues early on. I've just seen too many cases where the first time they're truly aware of the issues when you're preparing them for trial. And that's the worst time for them to become familiar with the issues, because often they will then say, well, why hasn't this been resolved?
Why are you telling me this now? Or why are you telling me this? Wait a minute. I didn't make this dispute.
Well, and as you know, I mean, disputes are something that grow over a period of time, and management that's at the program level often has something invested themselves in the dispute.
Right,
they may be trying to hide something, they may be trying to save their own reputation, and these things just snowball and until somebody who doesn't have that same vested interest gets involved.
Or someone like us who says, I want this off my docket, I want to go home at night. Do you have like a standard spiel or a standard explanation that you give to people about what mediation is and how it operates? And I find that kind of almost fall into a routine of saying, look, it's not like we're going to an arbitration. It's not going to be a judge. There'll be a neutral person there. That person's role is to facilitate. Do you have a standard routine?
We do. In fact, I've insisted that all of my lawyers have actually either done mediation training or at least have attended some type of seminars on mediation, so that they have a good understanding for mediation themselves. And we spend a lot of time in preparing the management before we go to mediation, because it's very important that they do understand that really that day or those days are meant for them to play a leading role and for the lawyers to step back.
And that they have to convince the other side, not the mediator. You got to get that across too.
Absolutely, which is a bit foreign. But I find that once managers have gone through the process, particularly where it's been successful, then you've really won an advocate.
That's right. And I was going to say, you get an advocate for the process. And you know what's interesting, too, is that they seem to actually enjoy it. Now, we shouldn't be encouraging people to actually create disputes, but when they leave the mediation, in fact, one of the things I tell them to bring, so what should I bring to the mediation? I say, bring a good book, because we're going to spend a lot of time preparing for this. And may not be more prepared, but we'll be the prepared party at that mediation.
Right.
And there will be a lot of time where we're going to be sitting in a room by ourselves waiting for the mediator to come back from a meeting with the other side. So, relax, bring a book. And they find it to be some bring books, some bring work. And they find it to be a very interesting and even fun experience, because we try to figure out what is it that we'd like to accomplish, what are the opportunities that we can put on the table.
Right. Well, I think you put your finger on it. It's the opportunities. You're not simply looking at the dispute. You're looking at the relationship.
Right.
And often, although perhaps it's trite to say that, but often you can bring more to the table than simply resolving that dispute. And there are other opportunities that develop out of the mediation, other business opportunities.
Right. No, it's for anybody who's gone through it once with a senior business person, it's great to see that person afterwards. I mean, they may even call you and say, look, I got this dispute coming up. Maybe we should consider mediation. It's not a dispute yet.
Right. Well, and of course, that's the other thing I try to emphasize to the business people, is that mediation, or at least some form of a third-party neutral assessment, can be utilized in the course of a contract and in the course of performing a contract when issues arise on a particular program.
You bring in
a neutral, perhaps, to resolve it between
and
the parties.
The project
and
moving.
Keep the project moving.
Well, in fact, let's turn to contracts in general and dispute resolution clauses. I think based on some of our discussions outside this recording, it sounds like your business is similar to mine in that a lot of your contracts, you don't just impose a dispute resolution clause, you negotiate dispute clauses.
Right.
What do you do with mediation? Are you trying to get mediation in your contracts? How successful are you in proposing?
We are. I mean, we're trying to. A lot of our contracts are multinational type contracts. They're cross-border contracts. So We try to build into these contracts a stepped dispute resolution clause.
Requiring mediation or opposing it as an option?
No, requiring mediation. Yeah, yeah. I mean, I know there's a lot of debate on whether you should actually impose that in a contract or not.
So. You know, for international contracts, I don't think there should be much of a debate, because the problem you have is that if you don't require it, the other side will never try it. It's too novel. It's too new for me.
That's been our experience as well, precisely. So even though that might then bind you to mediation at a stage earlier than you might otherwise think is right, the other thing I always tell people is you can mediate as many times as you want during a dispute. So the first time might be too early. But you might as well try it at that stage, and then you can always try it again if it doesn't work. So you're absolutely right. I think having it in the contract, that then requires the other party to abide by that, and you build mediation into it. We would then normally have an arbitration clause if mediation failed in our international contracts.
Well, also because the lawyers who negotiate these contracts, or the business people who negotiate these contracts, seem to demonstrate a lot more flexibility and openness towards mediation when you propose it in the negotiations than the lawyers who are involved in handling the disputes.
Right.
You know, it varies from country to country.
Right.
Here in the UK, for example, where you're based, you probably have no difficulty proposing mediation.
No.
The same in the US and Canada, where it's very well known.
Right.
But outside those jurisdictions, it becomes, or Australia, you know, it becomes pretty tough.
It does, certainly. You know? I mean, if we're talking about Europe and looking at some of the continental jurisdictions, particularly the local bars are still very much opposed to it, because I think they still see that as being an obstacle to their perhaps earning as much money as they might.
Yeah. I'm not as cynical. I know that a lot of people say that, and I think it's just they're not familiar with it yet. They haven't seen it work, because I think the lawyers too live off of the long-term relationship. But when particularly in the civil law jurisdictions, when you know the operational concept is, you know, what is not expressly permitted is prohibited.
Right.
Whereas in the common law, the principle is what's not expressly prohibited is permitted.
Right.
You know, and
so
they don't really have a framework to fit it into.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think that's true as well. And speaking to lawyers in these various jurisdictions, I've yet to find somebody who actually says I would never suggest to my client that we mediate because it would lose business me. I mean, nobody's actually going to admit that to you, but. You know, I think you're right. I mean, mediation is something that still is novel on the continent, and there are still many people that don't really understand what mediation is. In fact, that's one of the things that I've been working with CPR and also the Chartered Institute here in the UK and their European branch. I'm one of the directors on that branch, and we've been looking at ways to try to educate people as to what mediation is. And we've gone out to places like the Czech Republic and to Poland and just recently to Croatia.
Wow.
And met with largely in-house lawyers, but also outside lawyers. And just talked about mediation and the benefits of mediation.
Yeah. So you guys like to be associated. I mean, we like to be associated with mediation. I mean, we're active in promoting it as well.
Right.
Because we think it's a good thing. It's part of bringing about social change, really, with legal systems. Because once the big businesses do it, you know, you hope and you think that maybe lawyers will start to get it, and it will, you know, radiate further out, and so it will make it into other sectors.
Right.
By the way, interestingly enough, I have to tell you, maybe you've had similar experiences, but I have found Norway to be an isolated pocket where, I mean, maybe it's just anecdotal, but every time we've had a dispute there and we've proposed mediation, we've had no problem getting it accepted, and we've managed to resolve disputes.
Right.
People seem comfortable. They know it. So
that's interesting. Yeah. I've not yet. Although we have a company in Norway, we haven't actually had a dispute there.
You might want to try.
So, we might try to have a dispute. Yeah. Well, that's good to know.
Well, let's talk about arbitration clauses, because you said that you if you don't manage to settle, your clauses are drafted so that if you don't settle in mediation, then the next step would be arbitration. Now, institutional or ad hoc?
Do you... No, generally, we'll agree to institutional arbitration. It's simply easier to agree with the other side. You normally find reluctance on other parties to agree ad hoc arbitrations. Yeah. Although, you know, I myself think that occasionally those are probably the appropriate types of arbitration clauses to utilize, but normally it's institutional.
Okay, and you're having good experiences with institutions, or what's the... Let's not name names here, but...
No, I think what's happened with arbitration, and you hear this this comment frequently from certainly from in-house lawyers, is that it's come to represent much the same procedure as state court litigation procedure. Certainly, when you're dealing with people who are used to the Anglo-Saxon type of state court process, the arbitrations tend to follow much the same course. Particularly when you start looking at discovery and discovery requirements. And what we found is that arbitration can often be more expensive than state court litigation.
So in a contract between, let's say, two UK entities here, you probably would prefer courts over arbitration. You wouldn't see any real need for arbitration.
Right. I mean, I think it would very much depend on who we're contracting with and where. And certainly here in England, we think, you know, the commercial court is a very good court. And in fact, we could probably have a decision much faster than if we arbitrated. Certainly that's been our recent experience, so that we probably wouldn't then have an arbitration clause in that particular contract, whereas there are other parts of the world where we just wouldn't feel comfortable in a state court.
And, the courts may not. Yeah, do you contract with state-owned entities?
We contract with state-owned entities, but we often also contract with primes in those states.
Yeah.
So we're dealing with somebody who is not a state but a private company, and. Again, it will depend on where you are. Sometimes, even if you decide on arbitration, you might be forced into an arbitral system in that particular country. I mean, China is a good example where we often have to agree to CTEC, but we'd still rather agree to that than perhaps state court.
The state courts, right. So efficiency is an issue on, it sounds like, I would say not, I hear not frequently from my colleagues in-house, almost constantly about arbitration, where, you know, we're recommending, and I think it's arbitration is still appropriate in many circumstances, but there are fair criticisms there. I'm curious, though, when you do have an arbitration, how do you go about selecting and appointing your arbitrators? What's the process that you use? And I'll lay out the reason that I think that this is a question that I'd love to have answered, you know, from someone who occupies a similar role in another company. I find it to be a woefully inefficient process with a lot of gossip, a lot of, you know, so-and-so heard from so-and-so that he or she doesn't really read the papers and has a very busy schedule, you know, and you just don't know what the filters are. You know, did they just have a bad experience or a bad outcome? It's a very approximate and I would say almost haphazard approach to selecting the people who are going to be arbitrators. And what we all seem to agree in the area is probably the most important part of an arbitration,
right?
Selecting the arbitrators.
Right. No, I would certainly agree with that comment. And I think, yes, I think not a science, perhaps an art, selecting the arbitrators. Much of it, I think, is, as you say, word of mouth. You'll speak to either, you know, the law firm that you might be using for that particular arbitration. You'll speak to colleagues and ask, you know, what their experience perhaps has been or with other people that you know in the arbitration community, hoping that they will be frank and honest and not simply be looking to promote somebody. I think part of the problem with respect to selection of arbitrators is that arbitration, much more than mediation, is really appears to be anyway a closed club, and so you see the same names coming up over and over again, and they might in fact be very good people, but because they're being put up so often, they're also extremely busy people, so they might not even be able to give your particular dispute the attention that it ought to be getting. And there, although I guess in recent years there is been a larger number of new people coming into arbitration, I think that's still one of the criticisms that I have, that it's just not open enough to other people. And in fact, and I'll say this quite candidly, to women, I mean, there are very, very few female arbitrators, and yet there are a lot of female lawyers, certainly here in Europe, that could probably do it, but it's simply very difficult. And I know, having talked to some of them, it's very difficult for them to break in.
It's tough to break in, and those who have broken in are very busy, like the others.
Right.
You know, it's it's a real problem for a lot of us.
It is. I mean, you've got lists. I mean, CPR, for example, has a list, so you can go to these lists. But again, even with the best will that institutes like CPR have, it's difficult to actually determine how good somebody is from a resume.
Or what they may have been good 5 years ago. The problems I've had is that you appoint someone based on an experience someone else had 5-6 years before, when the person was up and coming and worked really hard and wanted to establish a reputation.
Right.
Now they've established the reputation, and they're so darn busy that, that they're just not the same arbitrator who was given the positive evaluation 5 or 6 years before. I've had that happen more than once.
Right.
So
selection of arbitrators is still difficult, I think, and I'm not sure if there is a good solution to that problem.
I don't know there is. I've proposed or I've discussed the possibility of, you know, formal feedback systems where you could actually get feedback on arbitrators and a third party that would collect that and make it available.
Right.
Something that would need a lot of attention and be tough to manage, but I'd certainly love to have a service.
Right. Well,
like that maybe one day there will be. I sort of feel if if someone doesn't do this, Wikipedia is eventually going to get there.
Right. they may, although they get a lot of their facts wrong. So.
Well, that's what I'm saying. So either someone does it right and does it in a quality way, or if we parties or someone else don't go take this in our hands and do something with it, I think ultimately someone else will, and it may not be the quality that we'd like to see.
Well, I think, Michael, you've also put your finger on that one. It's really up to the users. I think it's people like us that really have to push for things like that, because, you know, the others have vested interests, and it's up to us as the users to push things like that.
Right. No. Listen, I mean, if you could avoid being evaluated, why would you want to be evaluated?
Precisely. You always hated that at school.
My boss is very good when he does my evaluation, but if I could say, look, this year, let's just skip the evaluation.
Right.
I don't think that would fly long in GE. Hey, listen, before we conclude, let's talk briefly. You and I have spoken before briefly about people getting careers in companies, doing the sort of jobs that you and I do, litigation or counsel in-house.
Right.
So I'll ask you, how would I get your job? And you can ask me if you want, how would you get my job? But it might be interesting for people to hear, you know, how they could get here.
Right. Well, I think personally that it's good for a young person who's interested coming out of their legal education. To go into a law firm for a few years, I think it's important to get some legal training in a firm, particularly because firms do a multitude of different things and have various disciplines within the law that they address. And I think it's good for people to get a fairly well-rounded training. And so I think the first step is to go into a law firm. What you actually do there, it might be on the commercial side, might be on the litigation side. I found personally that litigation was a great training ground because you were involved with so many different facets of problems within a business. So
That taught me a lot about business from the outside, and that was quite valuable when I went inside, because I understood what the outside lawyers were actually doing, right. And it helped me to interface with them. Also helped me to critique them.
Oh no! We never do that.
No, of course. So I think you know that would be my advice to begin with. The other thing I think that's important is move around in the company. Once you're in a company, move around. I know within our law department, we've got operations lawyers who are out there with the businesses, and then we've got various specializations. While you know the opportunities are limited to do this in Europe because we've got a fairly small group of lawyers, certainly in the United States, we try to move our lawyers around so that they get experience in various areas. And I think the more experience you have, then the better your opportunity for advancement in the company as well. And my advice is to move around, get as much experience as you can within the company. And you don't have to be wedded to one company. I mean, certainly move around within your industry or even various industries nowadays. I think the opportunities are quite great for lawyers to be able to do that, and a lot of the legal issues that are facing companies are not simply industry focused. I mean, they're general issues.
Right. You got to be informed on what's going on in the world.
So don't hesitate to move around. I've seen colleagues that have done very well by doing that as well.
I think if you were interested or people wanted to know, it's probably similar in my company and its culture, where the big law firm or the law firm back, not necessarily big, but a law firm background is helpful. I'd like to think that litigation is good training, but I know that other, certainly if you want to be a litigator within a company,
right.
Training as litigator is a prerequisite. I think that it helps to have a passion for doing litigation and if you want to be an international litigator within a company and you want to go after that international work, no matter where you are, what firm or business you're at, if you're willing to do a little extra work, to take on that extra work when the opportunity arises. If you do that over time, it takes a long time, but you begin to establish credibility because you're doing something that you like. And
yes.
So when you do things that you like, you tend to be better at it.
Right.
And people remember that, and they come to you for more, and opportunities, instead of having to create them, they begin to knock on your door
right.
after a while.
Well, I think you can do that within a company as well. I mean, you can take on increasingly divergent roles, and usually, people are quite happy if somebody volunteers to do something.
Right.
So if you volunteer, that's something that's looked on quite favorably.
Listen, in GE, you'd be careful if you volunteer, because people won't let you finish the sentence. They'll set up metrics and say, okay, I understood the concept. When are you going to deliver?
Right.
Well, this is wonderful. Thanks so much for taking the time.
You're welcome, Michael. It was a pleasure.
You've been listening to International Dispute Negotiation. This podcast is presented by the International Institute for Conflict Prevention and Resolution, CPR. CPR is a membership-based nonprofit organization that promotes excellence and innovation in public and private dispute resolution, providing an international resource for the avoidance, management, and resolution of business disputes. For further information about CPR, or to download archived versions of this podcast, go to www.cpradr.org. Questions about this podcast or the issues discussed can be addressed to idn@cpradr.org. The music of Note Noir is used with permission.